Okay, is everybody back?
Yeah.
Yep. All right, good.
Yep.
Okay, so first I'll ask, is there any announcements?
This is Roberta in Kentucky. We had some excitement over the last few weeks with Next Generation Science Standards, basically going to another review committee and having them basically find them deficient in a majority vote against them. This was a purely political act, and it was immediately overridden by our governor, our Democratic governor. So for now, Next Generation Science Standards are basically written into law. But we've been getting wind of a sort of a grassroots effort by this group of folks that came to all of these meetings that spoke out against them, that they're going to try.
In what avenue did they find them deficient? Did they say specifically?
They basically said that their constituents were against them. That they didn't. They'd only heard negative comments about them from their constituents.
And who made up this committee?
These were state representatives and state senators. I'm looking for my notes. I don't have all that stuff right in front of me. But basically, it's a small interim review committee. several of these folks are very conservative Republicans, and they are saying that they have only heard from people who don't want Next Generation Science Standards. So that's very concerning to the State Board of Education and folks like me, because I've written to my senators and representatives, and the state board, when they were soliciting comments, received thousands and thousands of comments, and the vast majority were in support of the standards. So we're really going to try. We need to try and get the word out to get people to write.
And what is the I guess it is legal for the governor to override the committee, but it just seems odd to me that he could do that. I mean, what's then the purpose of a committee? I'm glad he did.
It bounces back and forth. There's so many little hurdles that the standards have to pass to get accepted officially, and he basically vetoed their or overrode their vote of
mm-hmm.
So anyway, when our General Assembly convenes in January, our legislators convene, we are hearing that there could be an effort to get the to get our state legislators to repeal the 2009 Act that, or Senate Bill 1, that basically required us to have these new standards in the first place. That would be a real travesty if that happened. So we're trying to get the word out.
That's a separate thing from adopting the standards?
Well, yeah. If they repealed that, then the standards wouldn't have to be adopted, I think is their thinking. So we're trying to get a little more substantial information about who is leading this fight and how they plan to go about it.
Okay. So this is just going to be an ongoing battle.
Yep, it sounds like it. But the schools themselves and the Board of Education are proceeding to implement, they're very worried, I can tell you that. I've spoken to some of the people in the State Board of Education, and they're very concerned, and they feel like they themselves can't do a whole lot because of their position, but they really hope that people will write to their representatives and their senators and voice their support.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thanks. Other announcements?
Well, this is Scott. I don't know whether there's anyone from California, but I have better news. What I understand from yesterday with Craig Strang from Lawrence Hall of Science is that California actually did pass the Next Generation Science Standards, though they need to go back and do something around middle schools. There's a requirement to split them up so there's not middle school, just 6, 7, and 8, but actually to split those into pieces, and apparently that's something to be done somewhat in the future. But it seems like California has already adopted Next Generation Science Standards.
That's good news.
That's
great.
Yeah.
Sorry, guys. I was late. Did you guys already mention Delaware just did it as well?
No.
Yeah, I just heard that.
I didn't see that. Great. And I was just down in New Mexico, and they were saying that they thought that they were on track for adopting. And I know that I've talked to the science coordinator, state science coordinator in Oregon, and she thought that we were on track for adopting, probably by the end of the year.
Excellent.
Great. Other announcements?
This is Chris. Oh, I'm sorry.
Go ahead, Kristen.
Yeah, I just had a couple of things, I guess. First of all, just because we're a partner on it, and I should mention the Climate Change Live webinar series is starting up in a couple weeks here with through the U.S. Forest Service and Project Learning Tree, a whole bunch of partners. And I know they've come through. We sent it through the listserv, but there's a great lineup for the year of interesting presentations, and those will be taped as well, and so they'll be archived for folks to go back and listen to them.
What we can also do is we can post it on the Facebook page when they're coming up.
Yeah,
you can actually do that yourself. Just go to the Facebook page and post the link and say what it is.
Yeah, I will do that. Great idea.
Okay, great.
And we closed out, we were doing through the EE Capacity a national needs assessment. We just closed it out last week with 320 respondents, and so we're looking at the data right now. But I know we're doing some comparison between formal and informal educators, as well as there was a pretty much 50-50 split on NSTA and NAAEE membership, so looking also from that perspective, environmental educators and science educators. And so that'll be something really fun I can do a presentation on in a couple months, probably.
And what was the specific focus of the needs assessment?
It was asking educators if they're teaching climate change, and then if they are, what areas they're focusing on primarily, what needs they have. So in what areas do they feel weakest, where they need more resources? And also, what resources are they already aware of or using?
Okay,
were kind of the pieces that came out. Yeah. And then here in Minnesota, we got some good news. We applied for funding through our Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund, and we made it to the second phase, and it's a statewide education, basically education campaign for doing public forums and educator workshops for 2 years. And so we'll be presenting before our legislative commission in 2 weeks on that. And it's similar to, I was listening to Roberta, really, it's the same kind of process where you present, and then it has to become a bill, and then they have to recommend, and then the governor has to sign it. And so it's a long process, but we're excited to have made it to phase two of that process.
Good.
Yeah.
Other announcements?
This is Jean McGregor at the Evergreen State College, and just when the call was starting, I was mentioning the Pacific Northwest Climate Science Conference, and this has been organized mainly by Phil Mote, M-O-T-E, at Oregon State University, a two-day conference, mostly with agency people present, and both federal, state, et cetera, reporting on a whole variety of climate effects. And then there was a whole set of concurrent sessions on adaptation, that was excellent. There was a pre-conference workshop showing what Portland is doing around adaptation work, that it was very, very impressive. I wish there'd been more educators present, but the timing was not great to do something in early September when everybody's in startup. But it was just a splendid conference. It's an annual conference and super well organized. I was just wondering if other parts of the U.S. are having such conferences.
We're actually planning a 10-year Midwest-focused one. We're just starting the planning phases one. But I'm going to follow up with you and ask you just about this. Ours would be focused on education, but...
This was really a research conference.
Very cool.
People reporting on research, but there were some great presentations on things really going on the ground. Like one presentation was, can the city of Seattle do better than Kyoto?
Hmm.
And the answer is yes, and they met the Kyoto.
I was going to say, I probably yes.
By 2008, I think. And their goal was to meet it by 2013 or something. They were 5 years ahead of the curve. So interesting, but it was great because it really gives the whole creates a community for the researchers to collaborate among each other. It was very well done, I thought.
How many people were there?
I would say over 400 people came.
Oh wow, wow!
Maybe
that's
close
great.
To 500. I mean, it filled a ballroom. So
that's great.
Impressive. Yeah.
One possible thing to explore for next year with that conference, and maybe Kristen with your new emerging conference, is to actually connect the researchers of these two communities, because there are learning researchers, educational researchers, social science researchers, media researchers who are involved in this larger climate objective that usually those conferences, as amazing as they are, and I know a lot of the PIs who are involved in those and program managers, but they tend to forget that there is a research component to what we do on the literacy outreach media engagement side of the equation that is critical to the work that they're doing and vice versa. But they only think of us as practitioners, not as researchers as well.
Mm-hmm.
Agreed. Good idea.
No, I agree with that. That's been a real big goal of this one that we're just starting to focus, because we'd be going at it more from education angle, but also bringing in the scientists that we have a great plethora of here as well to support the knowledge part of it. So, but that's a good point, Frank.
This is Mona. On that note, I would like to mention a project that we at Texas Sea Grant and a few other partners in the state of Texas are beginning with. It's just coordination activities of climate change adaptation activities within Texas and in the Gulf of Mexico region. And I wonder if there is some interest in the education community to participate in this effort as we take it forward.
Well, Mona, this is Tamara Ledley. One of my projects, we actually are working with Kathy Ellens at the University of Texas, Austin, and have a professional development program around climate change in Texas. So we should potentially talk and see where we might leverage efforts.
And I'm glad that you mentioned that, because I'm on that project with Tamara. So we're going to be submitting a proposal in response to the Be Wet call. And I so she did mention you, and so we're already underway.
Okay, terrific.
Yes, thank you.
Tamara, this is Roberta. I forgot to mention, I know you really want to get into your presentation, but we had huge news here at my workplace just a week and a half ago, when my boss was appointed essentially as Kentucky's new climate czar. He hates that phrase, but he was pulled away as director of the Division for Air Quality for Kentucky and was appointed to be Assistant Secretary for Climate Policy. It's the first time we've ever had any position like the state of Kentucky. So that is big, big news.
Yeah.
It's also one of the first states, I think, in the nation to have positioned that high up, devoted to
what
climate policy.
What's his title? Assistant Secretary for
Climate Policy.
climate policy. Terrific.
You know, one member of our climate literacy community, Don Bosch, who is the I guess one of the PIs for the Made Clear grant, is close to that position for Maryland. So we may, you know, convening some of those people to share practice because the Made Clear grant was the emissions plan that the governor of Maryland laid out actually had in the outreach engagement part Made Clear as one of its projects. So there's some precedent of our work in contributing directly to these state initiatives. So just something to think about as it moves forward as possible.
Okay, just a couple of other things that I just had some announcements about before I get into the presentation is I wanted everybody to know that Mark McCaffrey and I yesterday were interviewed by Tom Bowman for the Climate Report. It's going to be a podcast, and I'll send an email out to everybody once it's posted. It's supposed to be posted, I think he said, Saturday morning. But the focus was around climate change education. So that might be of interest. Another thing that I want to make sure I've sent out emails, but for those of you who have presentations at the NAAEE meeting, we are putting together a list of all the presentations from the Clean Networks so that we can hand it out to people and show people where climate-related, climate change education-related sessions are. So you should send that to me.
Thank you, Tamara. I have a question for you.
Yes.
Will you please make an effort? We all got together at last year's NAAEE conference, whoever was there, and might it be possible to have that happen again this year?
Sure.
We'll
send out an email and get that. Yep, that's a good idea. I'll make sure that happens.
Maybe we could do a doodle poll or something so we make sure that we're all available at the right time to get together.
Yeah, no, we'll figure out it. We'll figure out it. I won't just declare a time. We'll sort of we'll narrow it down first by the people who are going, and then we'll focus the attention on exactly when that might happen.
Fantastic, terrific.
And just so that those of you know who are going, go ahead.
Well, just a real quick question for you. Sorry, this is an urgent, not urgent. There's a need that is emerging. Let's just put it that way, for larger scale initiatives for making progress in this area. I can't really be too specific about what I'm talking about yet. Sorry to be veiled, I think it would be valuable for us to spend. Usually, those conversations are more social, and they sit in a bar or something like that, and it's really hard to actually have a focused conversation. It would be interesting to see if there's a place, and I don't know if any of the NAAE leadership or people have something to do with that could help us find a better space to have a more strategic conversation. The timing on this meeting is really fortuitous, but the location we did it last time was not. So I'm just wondering if there's a better way.
So what I'll do, so maybe what we can do is possibly we can identify two potential times, one that is so that anybody who wants to be social can get together, and one for more of a strategic conversation that might be fewer of us, but we can find a quieter place to go. I think that would be worthwhile. Okay? So I'll work on that.
Thank you.
Okay. The other things that I wanted to mention this may be interesting, of interest. I attended a workshop a couple of weeks ago that was funded to explore the possibility of establishing an institute for environmental environmental software sustainability. I forget it's ISEES, but I'm not getting the letters in the right order. But it's for software that addresses environmental issues and for the sustainability of that. And one of the things that was really clear, this is a group of people from the ESA Federation, which I'm involved with, which is mostly technologists, but I was one of the few education voices there. And so I kept piping up, but I may end up calling on this group at some time in the future in terms of providing input to that group. And just then to follow up with professional meetings, we do have the two sessions at GSA I do have an update on the climate literacy sessions at AGU. They are all scheduled on Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday of the AGU meeting. I think I got the schedule, but I can't really post it yet. Most of the oral sessions are in the morning and most of the poster sessions in the afternoon, but in some cases that didn't always work out. And the other thing that's very exciting about this is all the climate literacy sessions will be in rooms that are video on demand. And so as long as the speakers agree to have their sessions videotaped, recorded, they will be available from AGU's site. Steve was not sure that they would be available in real time, but they'll certainly be available for anybody who wants to see them afterwards. So that's really exciting because you have to be in special rooms in order for that to happen. So
we kind of looked out there
and everybody else can, and what would be really nice to know after this happens and we can post the information about where to get it is how many members of the Clean Network actually make use of these presentations. So,
Tamara, this also connects back to our social media kind of enhanced strategy. Because we could syndicate, radiate, market those now that they exist. Or soon will exist.
Right. Okay, great. I'll keep that in mind. Okay, so I'm going to now, we're actually already quite long into our time, and so I'm going to get into the presentation here. I'm actually going to skip the bio here. Most people on the call know who I am. You can read the bio on the website. People should have the slides, and I will try to. There's no numbers on the slides themselves, but I'll refer to it by slide number. Okay, so we're going to go to slide two, which just sort of gives you an overview of how we view clean at this point. And there's a clean community of which the Clean Network is a major, the major part of it. It's made up of individuals, as all of you know. But then we have some specific focus on educators. And on resource developers, now obviously these educators and resource developers can be members of the Clean Network also, but the Clean Portal addresses these groups also much more specifically. And then Clean Partners are partnerships with organizations. And then we have the Clean Resources, and that is made up of the Clean Collection, which you all know, the pedagogical support pages, and some professional development opportunities at times. We don't have many at the moment, but we're hoping to have more. So if we go to slide three, and again, most of you actually know most of this information, but just to reiterate, the Clean Network was formed in January of 2008 after that first version of the Climate Literacy Essential Principles was published. It did go through a major revision and was published again in 2009. And all of you are aware, that's the one that everybody refers to now. We have an active listserv in which we'll get into the details of the survey in a minute, but 98% of the people that responded said that they read the listserv frequently or sometimes. And we have these weekly teleconferences. And we're also very professionally diverse, and we'll get into the details of this, but there are over 21 professions represented and 60 professional organizations. So the purpose of this presentation is to sort of give you an overview of the outcomes of the survey. And there were 19 questions on the survey. They were multiple choice for the most part. A lot of them had open responses available for people to provide additional information. We covered four broad areas, awareness of the Clean Network, use and participation in the Clean Network, composition of the Clean Network, and future activities of the Clean Network. And I'm actually going to cover mostly the first three of those. Future activities there was things all over the place in terms of people's ideas about what we might do. A lot of people just said, keep doing what you're doing, but we had lots of other ideas, some which would require funding and some which might not. Anyway, we sent the invitation for responding to the survey to the listserv, so only members of the listserv got it. At the time, there were 381 members. Over the course of the survey, that did increase some, but there are currently 409 members, and the survey was open from March 18th to April 8th. And of the 381 people, we got 116 completed surveys for about a 30% response rate. So, Anna, I do want to acknowledge, since I kind of skipped the first slide, that Anna Gold was very, very helpful. I mean, she really helped put the survey together and helped me go through it. So I appreciate her contribution. I think she's on the phone. And if there's any questions that have to do with that in particular, she's here to answer those questions. So first I wanted to just show the state representation in the Clean Network as of May. We have all but, I think, 7 states represented at some level or other. And then we also have some non-U.S. Members. And also the state's unknown, and the history of that is that when the Clean Network first formed, we weren't really on top of identifying everybody's contact information. And so those people who never let us know where they were, that's why they're states. Because now when people join, we find out where they live. Okay, if you go to the slide 7, one of the questions we asked was how long have people been a member? And so this sort of just gives you a perspective. We started with about 20 people in 2008, and you can see that 11 people responded to the survey, have been members that long. And so, you know, there's a lot of us founding members that are still around. And our largest growth has come in the 2011-12 timeframe. I won't say anything about within the last year, since within the last year is a very short period of time when we took the survey. So if we go to the next survey, we wanted to just get a sense of what activities people were aware of from the Clean Network. And so the first item is the listserv, and I must say that we actually asked the question about the listserv archive, because if they got the link, then they're on the survey and they actually read it. So we figured that was a good, 100% of the people that responded to the survey, we figured were aware of the listserv. So we asked specifically about the listserv archive, and 71% of the people said that they were aware of the listserv. And we also then asked about the teleconferences, and we had two questions. One was about presentations, and the other was about informal discussions. As everybody who's on the call knows, that sometimes we have presentations like this, and sometimes we have sessions where we have informal discussions about topics that are of interest. And so most of the people are aware of the informal discussions, and really not too much lower percentage are aware of the presentations. But then some of the things that we don't have ongoing activities about but are a very important part of the Clean Network is the coordination of our presence at professional meetings, such like we were just talking about GSA and AGU and NAAEE. And the first one, so there's two percentages here. One was that they're aware of that we organize and make presentations at these meetings, and 84% were aware of that. And then the social gatherings, and only 54% were aware of that. And that probably comes from the people on the calls probably know more about the social gatherings than those on the listserv. So. And then the next question had to do with whether people were aware of the Clean Networks providing input into the next generation science standards, both the framework and the draft. And a little bit lower percentage, but certainly a significant percentage, two-thirds to three-quarters of the people were aware of that input. And then aware of input in the development of the literacy documents, in particular the climate literacy essential principles and the energy literacy essential principles, and over 50% are aware of that. And then just under 50% aware of our Facebook page. So in terms of participation, in terms of those people who responded to the survey, awareness of these various activities, which do make up most of the activities of the Clean Network, people are really involved with. So if we go to slide 9, I think it's 9, yes. One other question we asked, which is slightly different than the Clean Network, was we asked people how they had interacted with the Clean Collection Project. As most of you know, the proposal that funded the building of the Clean Collection grew out of conversations from the Clean Network. And so
we ask people, you know, if they use a resource and if they use it for their own use and with students, and about 41% indicated that they use resources from the Clean Collection. We asked people if they referred somebody to the Clean Collection, and about half of people had done that. And we asked if people submitted a resource for inclusion in the Clean Collection. And as you might imagine, this takes a little bit more individual initiative to submit something, but 22%, or almost a quarter of the people responded, said that they had done that. And then 16% of the people had either conducted an individual review or had served on a Clean Review panel. So these are people that have really been involved with the Clean project. So that kind of covers the range of questions we asked about the awareness of the Clean Network activities. And so we're going to go on to engagement with the Clean Network activities. So I first wanted to just pause and see if there were any questions about that initial part. Was there areas where you have some questions about, or areas in which you think we should sort of think about asking in the future? Okay, well, if not, we'll move on to engagement of the members in the Clean Network. That's the slide is slide 10. You have to remember that you're not seeing them as you change. So if I'm on a slide that you don't recognize, then let me know so I make sure I can tell you what slide I'm on. So we're going to go to slide 11 now. And we asked people how often they call into the Tuesday teleconference, today's teleconference. And so now there was 116 respondents here, and as you can imagine, you're probably aware, not everybody calls in. There's, 380, now over 400 people on the listserv. Four of the people who responded call in most Tuesdays, and you can probably guess who they are. And then we asked people if they called in once or twice a month, or once every few months, or calling in about once a year, or they never call in. And so what we see is that those people who call in most Tuesdays or one or two times a month, that's 16%. 25% call in every few months, so that those top three groups constitute 41%. And so I would suggest that's probably a reasonable range for people that are very active. If you want to call somebody very active in the teleconferences, those three categories is 40% of the people who responded. So I thought that was pretty good. Then those people who call in once in a while, at least once in a while, that covers 64%. So two-thirds of the people that responded to the survey call in at least once a year. So now if we go into the next slide, slide 12, we actually track how many people call into every teleconference. So we actually started recording this information in August of 2010. And so you can see the variations here. I think that every data point is here in terms of the presentation. So we've had over this period of time, which is August 3rd, 2010 through May 31st, 2013, we had 145 sessions with 57 presentations, and an average number of participants of almost 13. And that includes the summers. In the summers, we don't have presentations, and because people are traveling all over the place, the participation tends to be low. Just based on, I can give the, so we have the numbers for the average number of participants, but just from my tracking it myself during the summer, I can say we probably have somewhere around 5 each time. And during the academic year, we have somewhere between 10 and 20 on each call. You can see here the maximum participation we had in a session was 47. And that was the one where I presented the Clean Review process to people who are potentially proposing to the NSF Climate Change Education Partnership Phase 2 solicitation. So that was the maximum number, but we've had 12 presentations over this period of time with over 20 people in it. If we go to the next slide, we move on to, this is slide 13, we move on to people's engagement with the listserv. And I parse this out, so you can look at the number, the boxes, so this is a graph which identifies whether people are, we ask about whether you're reading the messages and if you and responding to the messages and posting messages. So this is, you know, three different levels of engagement. And you can, in the boxes right under the graphs, has the number of respondents. I've also redone that in terms of percentage of respondents so you can get a sense. And what was really gratifying is that, you know, most 85% of the people said that they actually read the listserv. And that 28% of the people said that they respond to the listserv. So so that was really nice to see. So that there is a significant engagement with the listserv. And we'll get to a little bit more of the range of people that actually engage with the listserv in a minute. I also can track the number of messages that are on the listserv. So these are the number of messages sent per month. And you can see that we have a variation in the, you know, sometimes we get into a conversation on the listserv that really elicits a lot of traffic, sometimes less so. But we average about 77 messages per month with a maximum of 160. And if you can sort of see that the line is trending up over this period. And we actually have this information from September 2009, and graphed here is through last May. If we go to slide 15, this one combines two different questions from the survey. It takes those that in the different colors, so the box on the right indicates how often people call into the teleconference, but then the bars indicate the frequency that they're engaged with the listserv. So for those people who are, let's just look at the first category here, which is reading the listserv. And the thing that was very gratifying to me was that, yes, to expect people, that all of you who are on the teleconference, you know, quite a bit, you all read the listserv. But even those people who never call in, the light blue bar at the far right of each group, even those people who don't ever call in have a very high engagement with reading the listserv. And while the people who call in most Tuesdays often also respond to and post to the listserv, a significant number of people also do engage with the listserv. And just to give you a sense of these numbers is that the three on the y-axis, the three is that they frequently read the listserv or respond to the listserv or post to the listserv, and zero is that they never do. So there is some level of engagement in all three of these categories for even people that are not, or never call into the listserv. And in the open response boxes, people did indicate why they didn't participate in the listserv, and the main reason was that it was scheduled at a time that they couldn't participate, and which isn't surprising. So the other thing that we do, if you go to the next slide, which is 16, everybody knows that we post the slides and the recordings, and I was curious as to whether people made use of this, and I was really happily surprised that 31% of the people, so 35 of the 116 people actually look at the slides, and a significant fraction, 20%, actually do both. They look at the slides and listen to the recording, which means that we are reaching more people than can actually be on the can be on the teleconference. So our two avenues of communication and our ongoing communication do reach a much broader group and are serving this community.
Tamara,
is there a comment?
Quick question.
Yes?
Yeah, this is Frank. Have we ever thought about changing the time, doing something like a doodle poll, just to find if there is a better window than the one we've chosen?
No. But to tell you the truth, I really don't want to go there. part of the reason is that we have a very engaged group now, and
yeah.
I've not, and we're never going to find a time that's going to work for everybody. I mean, in the fact that significant number of people know this time now, and even I know there are people that really do only call in once every few months, but they know what the time is. So
I appreciate the parallel. It's just a, you know, an open question.
So my sense is that, and it's not the very beginning of the week. It's not the, at one point we did have our telecons on Friday, which was excruciatingly difficult for me. And it was actually late in the day on Friday to accommodate somebody who participated from Hawaii. But that person didn't really remain engaged, at least not as far as I know. I shouldn't say this because I really don't know. But anyway, you know, unless there is a real groundswell that's consistent for another time, I don't think it's worthwhile trying to find another time.
Thank you.
Okay, so we'll go to slide 17. We wanted to get a sense of how the CLEAN members used the network. Okay, so going to slide 18. We, here, this is, you know, we provided a whole lot of choices. And I know this is a little bit difficult to read, so I will kind of read them for us. The very first one is, have you made a presentation or led a discussion on the Tuesday teleconference? The next one is, have you visited the CLEAN Facebook page? And so there's a significant number of people that have done that, 28%. Posted on the CLEAN Facebook page. Not many of you have, but you are all welcome to do that. It's easy to do, as most of you probably know. 25% of the people who responded have participated in a social gathering at a conference. Okay, and say it again. Okay. The next one is presented under the CLEAN Network's umbrella at a conference, meaning you've participated in our climate literacy sessions or provided your presentations for the NAAEW meeting to our list so that we can distribute that to participants. The next one is helped organize sessions under the Climate Literacy Network umbrella or CLEAN Network umbrella at a conference. So those of you, fewer have done that, 18%. The one thing that the largest thing that lots of people have participated in is people have visited the CLEAN Network website and teleconference page. And so we have 60% of the people who responded have done that. 18% of the people have collaborated on proposals with people that they've talked to on the network. Helped organize and run workshops with other CLEAN Network members is 16%, and 10% have participated in CLEAN Network working groups on specific tasks. This is like providing input on the next generation science standards or something that has a deadline that's more volunteer than project focused. So that's the various ways that we actually ask people how they participated in the CLEAN Network. And then if you go to the next slide, 19, there's a table that asks how you used your involvement in the CLEAN Network. And so we gave a lot of options, and people could check which ones they what people use the CLEAN Network for. The largest, as people probably would expect, is networking. 47% of the people said they use the CLEAN Network for networking. 45% said that they use it for discussing science or policy topics. 38% said they use it for teaching ideas. 28% getting input on an issue that your project is dealing with. Another avenue is posting or publicizing events for which you want participation. 27% have used it. And then community support, 24% have used it for that. So if you go to the next slide, slide 20, we asked people how important CLEAN Network was in their daily work. And 41% said that the Clean Network was essential or very important to their daily work, and that 96% felt that it was important at some level, and only 3% said that it wasn't important at all. So we fill a very important niche in this community that I think we should actually all be really proud of being able to contribute to. And so go to the next slide, 21, slide 21. We asked the question, usefulness of the Clean Network activities to members. So this is for various specific parts, the listserv, the teleconference, the website, the small working groups, and the social gathering. The level of usefulness, extremely useful, very useful, slightly useful, or not useful at all. And as you can see, the listserv is reflected in the earlier slides. The listserv is very useful. Are extremely useful to most of the people. I mean, if you combine those percentages, it's about 42% plus about 38%. We also find that the teleconferences and the websites are very useful for members. The small working groups and social gatherings, as you might imagine, because there's fewer people participating, is somewhat less useful. So clearly the listserv and the teleconferences and websites are important aspects of this community. And then we've asked the question, and I'll tell you that when I get people asking me to join, if they can join the Clean Network, most of them say, so-and-so suggested I contact you. And you can see 72% of the people who responded said that it was recommended to them by somebody who was from the Clean Network to join. So I'll pause there before going to the next section if there is any questions or comments about what I've covered so far in terms of the outcomes of the survey. Okay, so if we'll go to slide 23, the professional diversity of the Clean Network. We wanted to get an understanding of the stakeholders that were involved. You can kind of guess that there's going to be a lot of educators and scientists on the Clean Network. But I think a lot of us, through our discussions over time, have realized that this is a very interdisciplinary and transdisciplinary topic that requires input from a much broader community. And I think that we would like to grow the Clean Network such that we serve that wider range of expertise. But we wanted to find out where we are. So if you go to slide 24, we asked people what their professions were, and the ones that are in the table are the ones that we provided as options. And then we left an open text box. And so it didn't include, since the reason I have them separate from the ones that are in the open text box is separate, and this isn't all of them, this is just some of them. But because not everybody had the, since you could check as many as applied, so if you were involved in formal education and informal education, you could check both of those boxes. Since not everybody had the option to check the ones that people provided in the open text box, we didn't include that in the table in terms of a percentage of the Clean Network that answered that. But as you can see from the table, we have 34% of the people involved in formal education at the higher ed level and 14% at the K-12 level. We have 41% of those who responded in informal education. And then we did divide up the education roles a much more finer than you would for others. The professional development providers and curriculum developers made up 40 and 35% respectively. Then we get and move into scientists. 33% of the respondents said that they were scientists. Then we move on to other kinds of areas, public health specialists, social scientists, psychologists. We actually had 13% social scientists. That was really nice to see. Economists, urban planner, artists, media specialists, journalists, social media specialists, and technologists. We don't have any lobbyists. The one item we had in the checkbox is that nobody was. Anyway, so this is beginning to get at a larger range of people. Now, One of the things that was interesting, something that we didn't put in that people entered in the open text box, is that they were actually decision makers or managers, and five people said that they were in that area. We also had people who separated themselves from journalists and media specialists, calling themselves publishers, writers, or bloggers, and we had three people there. And then we had somebody working for the National Parks, somebody who was a policy analyst and a student. So you can see that there's a wide range, and I think that there are 20 different professions represented in this list. So that's a nice start, but we, you know, the bulk of the people are mostly in science education and in the sciences, and so we'd like to move that to include higher numbers in these other kinds of professions. But the other question that we asked to get at this a little better, if you go to slide 25, we also asked people what professional societies they belong to get a better sense of the range of professional societies. Because if you think of the CLEAN network as a network of networks, where all of you represent a network to a much larger community, if you're belonging to these professional societies, these different professional societies, then they represent a larger community of which we can impact. And so there's basically two kinds of groups here. Again, just like the professions, we identified options for people to just check off, but then we had an open box for people to enter other professional societies they belong to, and the list was huge. So I have there at the bottom that over 60 professional societies were listed by the survey respondents. Now, on the table here, I think you had to have had at least three people say that they belong to a society to be in this table. And so the ones with the stars next to them are ones that the respondents entered in the open text box that we did not have in the original set of options. So you can see we weren't really aware of all of the different kinds of professional societies that are relevant here, but we're learning. And so getting more robust connections to these other societies would help help us tremendously. So that basically summarizes the results from the survey. And what I'll tell you is that I put together a paper. It's co-authored by Anna Gold, who is on the phone, and Frank Niepold and Mark McCaffrey. And the others from the CLEAN Network, CLEAN Pathway Project, which is Susan Burr and Kathy Manduka and Sean Fox, to the Journal of Geoscience Education, which we submitted in June to a special issue on climate change education. And one of the things, I put this information in the context of trying to have larger collective impact. All of us have our impact on our communities through the activities and projects and programs that we have. But how can we enlarge that our impact through the CLEAN Network? The CLEAN Network. Now, we're getting, so you can go to the next slide, 26. We're getting short on time here, so I'm just going to introduce this now. But I think we might think about having one of our more informal discussion times, maybe to revisit just a brief overview of the survey results and really possibly talk through that. But in this paper, we posed that the CLEAN Network was a first step in enabling collective impact. And if you go to the next slide, 27, this collective impact was a concept that was published in a paper. It's the reference is there at the bottom. By Kanya and Kramer in 2011, called Collective Impact. And basically it poses that large-scale collective impact is needed that integrates effective climate literacy efforts for teachers and students as well as decision makers who need to address the implications of climate change in their decisions. The paper itself doesn't address climate change. The paper itself, the paper by Kanya and Kramer, does not address climate change. It just addresses how to have a large-scale collective impact on a societal issue. And their paper, so in the second bullet there, their paper suggests that you need five conditions to achieve collective impact. And they're listed there, common agenda, shared measurement systems, continuous communication, mutually reinforcing activities, and a backbone organizational structure. So if you go to the next slide, 28, I basically expound on these areas a little bit more. So the partners or contributors, the members of this collective, need to develop a common agenda. What is it that that needs to happen? And they also make the point that the common agenda is something that you don't get to that quickly. It could take a couple of years for this coordinated effort to really define what the common agenda is, in a way that you can then, in the next bullet there, develop a shared system of members to track progress. So what is it that you're actually measuring to say that you're achieving what is part of your common agenda? And then collective impact needs that group to engage in continuous communication that facilitates the building of the community of stakeholders. And in the paper, and now I would contend that the Clean Network does this in a big way, the continuous communication. The survey results reinforce this, is that those are the two most important aspects of our effort, is the listserv and the teleconference. And then to be able to identify mutually reinforcing activities that address this common agenda. So as you address the common agenda, everybody is looking for where is it that what I'm doing now, all of you, what the projects and efforts you are doing now can help support that common agenda, and what is it that are the outcomes that feed into this shared system of measures so that we can know how your efforts are supporting moving the common agenda forward. And then the last is to have a backbone support organization that engage and coordinate all stakeholders in addressing and implementing these elements. And I would suggest that the Clean Network is exactly that. It's the beginnings of this backbone support organization. And I will also say that the Kanya and Kramer paper also says that you need financial support in order to have a robust backbone support organization. So if you go to the last slide, 29, so I would suggest, and I did in the paper, that through its activities, the Clean Network is providing varying degrees in each of these different elements, the first steps towards establishing the common elements necessary to enable successful collective impact in addressing climate literacy and associated societal problems resulting from climate change. So we are at 2 o'clock. And so I wasn't sure I was going to get to this last part, but I'm glad I got the opportunity to sort of to get all of you thinking about Clean Network in the context of collective impact. The survey results certainly do support our moving forward in this direction, and so I'm willing to stay on for a few more minutes and answer any questions. And you can let me know whether you'd be interested in pursuing a conversation in a future call around this area.
I would. That was really helpful, Tamara. And
yeah.
I really liked the way you applied that paper to this. It was great.
I will say that in this presentation, I gave you a whole lot more of the results of the survey than are in the JGE paper, just because some of them are more relevant, I thought would be more of interest to you, but some of them get kind of down into the nitty-gritty details. So when I get more feedback from the review process for that paper, I will share it with everybody.
Do you have the full citation of the paper?
Yeah, that's the full citation. The Kanya and Kramer paper?
Yeah, I'm not seeing it on the PowerPoint. Is it there?
Yes.
Yes.
It's on the bottom of slide 27.
The
URL is there.
Oh, got it. Okay, great. Thank you.
Okay, it's there. And there is a follow-up paper. There is a follow-up paper that I also read that talks about how to implement it, and I used that also extensively in the paper. And we could post both of those on the same page with the abstract for this presentation on the teleconference page.
That would be great.
So, but this is, you don't have to pay for this paper. It's freely available. You just go to that URL.
And lots of people are using it. I found out about it from a foundation. I was applying for money, and they said, well, this is how we do it. So, you know, make sure that your proposal deals with the notion of collective impact. So it's definitely in the business.
Okay, well, if there are no other questions, are there any other questions?
No, I just wanted to say thank you for this presentation. It was really helpful.
Great. I'm really glad. That's
very
really
interesting.
Nice.
Very good.
Okay. Okay, so next week you heard, well, we're going to have another presentation by Kathy McLaughlin from Project Learning Tree, which you heard Christian refer to in a project that she is working on. So the slides will be there next week, and we will have another presentation then.
Excellent.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you
everyone.
Very much.
Bye now.
Thank you.
Bye. Bye, everybody.
Bye.